Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. By my count, we're on episode number 869. My name's Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois. And we got one of our regulars. He's been on the program several times and is back again and has taught a course even with the Reformed Academy. We're welcoming to the program the Reverend Dr. Daniel Ragusa. Dan is pastor of Messiah's Reformed Fellowship in New York City, right there in Manhattan, URCNA congregation. Welcome, Dan. So good to see you.
Thanks, Camden. Always good to be on the program here.
Yeah, I love that you're calling in. We're going to be talking about Dutch Reformed and American Presbyterianism, getting into some history. We have a lot of projects coming up soon that this is kind of an entree to. Dan has edited, he's translated and edited a collection of Cornelius Van Til's, what we call the Dutch letters. These are the letters that he wrote as part of a column in a Dutch publication named De Reformatie back in 1935, 36, those early times, which is a very critical moment in American Presbyterian history, especially from the perspective of an Orthodox Presbyterian, capital O, capital P. And Van Til was writing even as that church was going to be formed out of the Mainline Presbyterian Church. We'll talk about some of that today, but also Dan's got all sorts of other stuff going on. We've got several publication projects in the works here at Reformed Forum, and we'll talk about some of those in just a second. Before I do that, I want to mention that our website is up, and we've improved it with some new event features. So take a look at reformedforum.org, where there's a whole new content type now. Instead of just having events scattered on different pages, we actually have a whole listing of events specifically. And this allows you to do certain things as a viewer and someone is following our website. You can subscribe to a Google Calendar where you can get automatic updates with our upcoming events. And that's important because we have several. We have a conference coming up September 28th, 2024. Register now. The early bird rate is still in effect. And we have several tickets available for the main conference. There is a pre-conference event the night before, September 27th, and that also is here in Grace Lake, Illinois, nearby. So Libertyville and Grace Lake kind of are next to each other. And the office is in Libertyville. The church where I'm a minister is in Grace Lake, and that's where we hold our annual conference every year. But there's a pre-conference event that Friday night, September 27th, and separate tickets are available for that. There might still be one or two left. So get in now, and we'd love to have you come visit us there. We're also working on some other meetup events. It looks like Wednesday, September 11th, there will be a meetup in the Philadelphia area. We're targeting, working on the details in Glenside. So, Lord willing, I will be there. Most likely Jim Cassidy and Lane Tipton will be present. So if you'd like to come and hang out with some Reform Forum people and you're in the Philadelphia area, or you could get there, come on over to Glenside area. We'll have details all available at reformedforum.org. And we're also working on a meetup potentially that Tuesday night in South Jersey. So lots of stuff going on and more to come later in the year. So stay tuned. And the best way to do that is to visit reformedforum.org and subscribe to our email newsletter where you can get all the updated information about our events, our new courses, publications, and podcasts. All right, Dan, thanks for sitting through that. But some of these new upcoming things you're involved with, I've been very delighted to be working with our publishing coordinator, Mrs. Margaret Grimm. She's tremendous, doing a lot of great work for us. And we've got several publications coming up. The Letters of Van Til, we're going to be publishing. That is in the works. But we're going to see here possibly in maybe a month or two, we're placed an order with the printer for a little booklet that you wrote on the Emmanuel Principle. Would you like to speak about the Joyful Fellowship a little bit, give us a preview into what you were doing, and hopefully whet the appetite of a lot of our listeners?
Yeah, so this project really is owing to Ryan Noah. In many ways, he kind of encouraged us to move and put it together. So a while back, I had written a number of articles for Reform Forum tracing the Emmanuel Principle, the God with Us Principle, throughout the scriptures, beginning in the garden and moving all the way to the end of scripture and the new heavens, the new earth. And so Ryan really encouraged us to, and me, I guess, especially, to put it together and edit it. and which we did, and looking forward to that coming out. The one thing that I tried doing with this, because there are of course a number of biblical theologies on the temple theme or the Emmanuel principle, and my work is very much indebted to those, like for example G.K. Beale and T. Desmond Alexander's works. And so in many ways, it's kind of distilling some of their insights and the threads that they've pulled on. But what I tried contributing in these lines is to make it more covenantally or con more covenantally conscious, where when we think about God with us, it is within the context of his covenant. And so that seemed to maybe make it more distinctly reformed, not to say the previous works aren't as reformed, but just kind of bringing that covenant theme out throughout the writing. So it's a small book. I think it's, you know, a one or two sitting read. But the few people that have provided feedback for it have said it's just been a helpful reminder, kind of getting the biblical storyline back into your head afresh, especially for pastors and, you know, preachers who are working through the scriptures, to have that redemptive, historical, biblical, theological mindset when we're thinking about a certain passage or so on. So, yeah, I'm thankful for Reformed Forum. Thankful for Ryan and Margaret as well for really helpful editing on that project.
It's looking good. It's a little 4.5 by 7 trim size, so it's a nice little, it's a book, but it's more the smaller side of book, but it's very rich. But even though it's rich, it's still accessible. So we're hoping that this would be the kind of thing people could buy a handful. It's going to be a great book, especially thematically, to, you know, give away for Christmas. I'm going to pitch this as like a stocking stuffer. You Dutch guys do stockings, or you do klompen? What do you do? What do you do?
I don't know. I mean, theologically, I'm Dutch,
Yeah.
but
Yeah, I know. I know.
culturally, I may not
Culturally,
be.
you're not. Well, what's the take with, we've got quite a few, you know, Dutch, ethnically Dutch folks in our congregation, and they seem to do, most of them are pretty just Americanized though. We don't have any that have any remnant accents or anything like that, but
Oh,
we do
well,
have some
we
that
have
were
some of
born
this
in
still.
Netherlands, but you know, generally speaking, in terms of cultural practices, other than like on New Year's Day, they do the well, the rough translation's fat balls. What is it's like a fried donut, like what's the name of it? The oh man, this is killing me. I'm
You know,
my
I
elder's
can't.
screaming in his truck right now as I can't remember the name of it, but I remember that if I translated it woodenly and literally, it's fat balls. It's basically a donut. It's like a fat fried deep fried donut. They're
Not
wonderful.
Ollie Ball
It's
or
like, yeah, Ollie
Ollie.
balling. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
it.
Ollie Ball.
It's
Yep.
like a Dutch version of a funnel cake. It's the best.
Yep.
It's the best.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, the Dutch and the pastries, you know, banquettes and the Dutch letters, and it's. Yeah, that's one of the things I miss about being in the Midwest and
Yeah.
getting some good pastries from Jarsma's Bakery in Pella, Iowa. So if you're gonna looking for some Dutch stuff, go to take a trip to Pella.
Yeah, we'll get into that with the Skolty and the settlement there, Van Ralty in Holland, Michigan. But even Highland, Munster, you know, where you went to seminary and where I serve on the board and have taught in the past down in Mid-America and where Van Til grew up in Highland, you know, you still have some good Dutch influence there. But you're in Manhattan, but what's happened? It's New York, but it used to be New Amsterdam. Is there any Dutch influence anymore? Are there any remnant? You know, like you've got the delis here and there, the Jewish delis. Are there any like little Dutch bakeries anywhere in the city?
You'll find stuff here and there. I mean, more it's the names of everything.
Yeah.
Like you'll find an Amsterdam Avenue, but then even the Bronx and Brooklyn, and all these places are named after Dutch places. So yeah, the Dutch were here pretty early, in the early 1600s, and yeah, New Amsterdam, New Netherlands at some point. And you know, and you'll find some pockets, you know, even just outside of the city on Long Island, where I grew up, a couple towns over in West Sayville, you had a big Dutch immigrant population there, and they were all clammers and fishermen. But then a large group of them moved to Pantego, North Carolina, where we
Oh,
also have
I
a
just I've
UR.
been there. Oh, that's exactly, and then I was hanging with Dutch folks. That's
So
great.
a lot of them have their origins, well, at least within America, in New York, Long Island. And so there's a lot of common last names, the Slagers
Oh,
family and so on,
yeah.
Van Essendelfs, and they're all in both areas. But yeah, a lot of
I
them
did
moved
not
to
know that connection. I
San
need
Diego.
to read. I've read parts of, but I haven't read all of Netherlanders in America, Lucas' book, which is awesome, awesome. But I love that. Well, this is really fun. We're going to be talking, starting off at least. But this is kind of like we're going to help the reform foreign people to get the medicine to go down. But and the medicine is learning about Dutch Reformed history and confessionalism. Now, most of our listeners are going to like this anyway and want to talk about it anyway. But I'd like to access this through the figures of Cornelius Van Til and Gerhardus Voss, perhaps two of our most favorite people to speak about here at Reformed Forum. But it's not going to be idiosyncratic or isolated. I'd love to get into the whole history, moving back even to the 16th century to talk about some of the background here. And this will be helpful for even American Presbyterians because so much of our history is dependent on and informed by what was going on in the Continental Reformation. And our histories have always been intertwined. And it's gone both ways, but in many ways, at least early on, a lot of that influence has been more highly developed on the continent and then applied to America, especially as America is being founded. And after its founding, as we've got Manifest Destiny and all these people homesteading and moving out west, the Reformed influence is largely, in many ways, influenced by the Dutch. And I think that's a good thing. And we're going to talk about why. For some extra context and another little bit of an announcement, my little article, my pamphlet, The Importance of Van Til for Today is now available as an ebook at reformedforum.org as well as on Amazon Kindle. We're working on getting copies of that printed as well, looking at different formats and talking with some different printers to get the pamphlet printed in a way that we can have a high quality printing that we can get lots of copies out and make it as affordable as possible, hopefully, so we can give a bunch of them away. So if you're interested in that, you can go ahead and get a copy on Kindle or head on over directly to reformedforum.org. There's an entire section. One of the main three sections speaks about Van Til in this early 1930s context, mid-1930s context, speaking about him as a child of the Afscheiding and how that informed and influenced his work as an American Presbyterian in the OPC and at Westminster Seminary. So we're going to talk about that. And you can also watch my delivery of that lecture. It started as a lecture for the OPC's Presbytery of Michigan and Ontario back in October. I don't know when it got posted on our website and on YouTube. It was either October. I delivered it in October of 2023. So you can dig back in the archives. If I'll remember, I'll also put that in the episode description. Okay, so we've been all over the place and talking about and setting the table. Why don't we jump right in and speak a bit about just the letters in general, if you don't mind? Let's talk about that project, Van Til's Dutch letters and the history of it, how we found them, and how you began working on them, and what's been involved. No doubt, we'd love to have you back and talk more about it when these are actually printed and we have a book that we're selling. So we hope we don't irritate too many people by giving too much of a preview and they can't go buy it. But soon, but soon. But Dan, how did you come across these letters? And let's eventually get into the historical context. Why are these important?
Yeah, so I first came across the letters, as a number of people might have, through the Van Til software, what it's called, but it was published on Logos Bible Software and had been put together actually by a previous member of my church that I pastor, Eric Sigward, who has gone to be with the Lord. And so these letters were never translated. So they're in Dutch, the Dutch letters. And various biographers, like even John Meether, had mentioned that he would love to read them, but there was no a full translation of all the letters. Here and there, a paragraph or two might have been translated. And so it became an immediate interest, just my interest in Van Til in general, and then realizing also the years in which he's writing, 1935 through 1940, are some of the most formative, actually probably the most formative years for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and even just thinking about Orthodox Presbyterianism in general, just in the United States. And these letters seemed extra special in the sense that it wasn't Van Til reflecting on these events later on, which is always a good thing, right? You get, you know, the Monday morning quarterback kind of thing, you know, to look back on stuff. But he's writing as it's all unfolding before him. And so there's a sense in which you really get into Van Til's heart and his mind as he's trusting the Lord, but also recognizing very formidable enemies and opponents. You begin to learn more, I think, in these letters and elsewhere of his deep admiration for Machen. He loved Machen,
yeah.
and he followed Machen. And so then in the midst of these letters, you know, Machen's trial is going on. He's deposed. And then he suddenly dies, right? New Year's Day. And you get Van Til publishing a letter as a tribute to Machen just a month later. And it's, you can kind of feel the emotion in it, in which he realizes the great loss that they had, but also Van Til's faith in trusting the Lord to move forward. So that's probably my favorite letter. It comes, you know, letter 12 of the 24.
We see that too. I want to jump in just because it's so pertinent on this context. You know, I've been doing an enormous amount of work. Well, from my perspective, I'm not saying this work is, you know, with great gravitas, but what I'm trying in terms of what's taking up my time is what I mean. I don't want to oversell this or make it sound self-important, but I've been doing quite a bit of work. A lot of my research and heavy lifting lately has been on the Stonehouse Presbyterian Guardian articles. I've been doing work on Ned Stonehouse, who also is, of course, a Dutch-American Orthodox Presbyterian. So very similar, roughly, you know, of similar age. I think he's 6 years younger than Van Til, five or six. Well, I mean, he's born in 1901 to 1961, I think. And Van Til was born in 1895.
Yep.
So just about 6 years. But he wrote the article that announced Machen's death for The Guardian. And it's the same type of tenor, you know, who lost a father in Israel. And you could just feel it. How devastated he is, but yet it is with that faithful mindset. And no doubt those two, as well as many others at Westminster and in the OPC, were grieving greatly, but they always looked to the Lord to provide.
Yeah. Maybe I could read just a small section from that, that letter, if that's okay.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So, He's mentioning throughout this letter how they thought Machen indispensable. You know, we thought he was indispensable to Westminster Theological Seminary. We thought him indispensable as the editor of the Presbyterian Guardian. We thought him indispensable as the leader of the Presbyterian Church of America. We thought him indispensable to Christian Science in the proper sense of Christian Science. And then he goes on to say, we thought him indispensable, but enough. God has taken him away. The Lord has given. The Lord has taken. Blessed be the name of the Lord. To him be the praise that we were able to have Machen with us until this time. God will carry on and accomplish his work still even now. Despondency would be a sin. A greater confidence of faith than ever before is our clear duty. And whenever I read that, I just get pretty fired up. And I think, you know, this comes at letter 12 of the 24. And I think you kind of see a bit more militancy in a sense from Machen following this, where I think that he realizes that with Machen gone, others need to have greater confidence of faith and move forward. And I think Machen kind of takes that on himself to a degree. I don't think he was trying to put himself forward necessarily, but I think there's a different tone I noticed in his letters moving forward, where there's more resolve and confidence as he presses on and deals with the disintegration of Princeton, with the importation of Barth and Bruner. He's dealing with the dispensationalists and the fundamentalists, still dealing with them, not as to as strong of a degree as he's dealing with Barth and Bruner, but he still recognizes some of the errors and the problems that dispensationalism was causing in the church.
That's the main feature in The Guardian. at those early times. I need to correct myself. So Stonehouse was 02 to 62. I misspoke. So I don't want to get the emails later, but I was a year off on both accounts. But anyway, yeah, I agree. It's amazing what you're pointing out in terms of the change in leadership and kind of a little bit of a generational change. The death of Machen, as tragic as it was, the Lord used to raise up a whole host of leaders that would lead the OPC, the denomination, and Westminster Seminary for many, many years, for decades. Stonehouse died quite early in 62. Van Til retired in the 70s and died in 87. I'm of the age now where Van Til was at this time. And you're a little behind me, you're younger than me, but you're probably right around the age that Stonehouse was at the time. Yeah. You know, so Stonehouse, you know, when the OP was founded would have been 34, and you know, Van Til when the OPC was founded would have been 36, would have been 41. So I'm 44. Yeah. So, you know, that it's wild to think that, oh, for so many years you think about these fathers of the faith, and now you're starting to think, well, when he wrote this, he was younger than me. And it kind of just puts you in a different mindset, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One other interesting thing we learned, or I learned in this letter, I don't think he mentions this elsewhere, but Van Til recounts some of Machen's works, and he mentions that his work, The Virgin Birth of Christ, was his greatest work, which I find interesting because if you've read The Virgin Birth of Christ, Machen is brilliant in it, but you also hear so much of Voss in it, in his arguments as well. And in some sense popularizing, but he's still writing at a pretty academic level in The Virgin Birth as he's dealing with these guys. But yeah, it's like the Van Til thought that Machen's greatest work was The Virgin Birth of Christ. And I think it shows something of Van Til's own admiration and love of Voss, who connects them all together.
Yeah. So in reading these and translating them, so you're fluent or conversant and certainly capable to translate the Dutch. What was your first experience to start to get into these? Did they meet your expectations, exceed your expectations? Were you surprised? I have my own thoughts about reading your translation, which I love. Mm-hmm. And it's been checked by quite a few people, even some old timers, which we're finding some fun stuff we can talk about. But what was your first impression when you were unlocking the contents of these letters?
Yeah. Before I jump into that, I should say, a good friend of mine, Jaap Vroegdenhil,
yeah,
who's in the Netherlands, he's an elder in a church out there.
You guys were tearing up my Doctrine of Man class.
Yes.
I say that affectionately.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we were both
and Arian, his son,
mm-hmm. when Dr. Busey was teaching our anthropology course. So Jaap is back in the Netherlands now, and his son Arian also helped look at some of the letters. And then another friend of mine, Michael Carney, who just recently began teaching at Dort in communications there. And anyway, so they went through my translation and provided some really helpful feedback, which you know you can read in the acknowledgments of the book when it comes out.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just pure joy and excitement going through these. It was just, it just felt like uncovering a treasure, and you know, a little hidden treasure that's there, but it's just in Dutch and not having read it, you know, in English and having it out there. So like, there's probably some really funny correspondences between me and Ryan. As I'm translating, I'm usually sending every letter once I finished it to him, and we're pulling out quotes and getting all excited about it. So. So yeah, I mean it, and I think as I said earlier, I think Van Til always wrote with showing his personality in a sense, but here you really have something that seemed very intimate in a sense to him. He's also writing back to his, you know, his fatherland and to his people, and he's trying to convey something to them about what's going on. So yeah, it just kind of gave a little new appreciation for Van Til, which, you know, having read most of, not all of his stuff, it's yeah. like to have that, it's like, oh, that's wonderful.
I think there's several factors that are working together in our favor as historians and people just want to be mildly entertained. It's always fun to read things to learn, but if you can be entertained or find joy in them at the same time, it's even better. So First off, I think just in terms of Van Til's age, you get a good mix where he's still young enough to kind of let loose, and he's not too buttoned up, but he's not popping off either, and he's not too young where he's immature. He's seasoned to a degree, and I like to think that this 40s is not a bad age, because since I need to think that because I that's my age. But so we have that. We also have the fact that he's writing in Dutch back to his kinsmen and in a publication. So the people who are immediately dealing or involved in this controversy are not going to read this. And they're not going to be able to understand it because it's in a different language. So, the people that he might be more sharply criticizing, he can feel free just to not be extra polite or tone it down. So he's not being inappropriate, but he's just writing freely. And because I think he knows this is never, it's never going to get back to these people directly. Who's going to go through the effort of finding this, translating it, reporting it to so and so? Whatever. But then the third thing is just because of these things, he's so funny. And probably a third of them are just really sarcastic in a funny way, not in an annoying way. But he's not doing a total send up or a farce or doing anything overt or really crazy, but the sarcastic tone is making fun and in many ways showing the ridiculousness of the modernists' proposals. And I just think it's the best. It's like political satire to a degree. It's not in that form, but it's like it's serving or scratching the itch that satire often does, where it gets at the ridiculousness of whatever you're criticizing.
Well, Shakespeare once said, jests oft do prove prophets. So like they're the ones who can tell the truth. And so sarcasm, the Bible, you find sarcasm in scripture. Think of Elisha
Oh,
with
sure.
the prophets of Baal. And you have so many instances where Van Til, yeah, is appealing or using the biblical stories to kind of make a little sarcastic point. I just pulled up one briefly if I can give another
Yeah,
little
go
snippet.
ahead.
So he's dealing with Dr. Edwin Lewis, who was a Methodist, but then was eventually embraced Barteanism and then was embraced by the Reformed. And so he opens the whole letter with a little a riddle. This is the fifth letter. And he says, Dr. Edwin Lewis was a Methodist, is a Methodist, and will remain a
Right.
Methodist. Dr. Lewis was an Arminian, is an Arminian, and will remain an Arminian. Dr. Lewis was a liberal, is Orthodox, and will remain a liberal. How is that possible? Maybe not in the Netherlands, but the Netherlands is also a very small country.
Yes,
This is not
exactly.
possible in America. America is indeed the land of wonders, wonderful things.
Exactly. Exactly. I love it. The land of opportunity. Oh man, that connects. If I'm not mistaken, I know of a Voss married and converted to Methodist. I married and converted to Methodist, but I think you did as well, didn't you?
Bible church
Bible
girl.
church. Oh,
I don't know
close
if
enough.
that from Texas,
This is great. Yeah, the tone of Van Til's letters are fascinating. Even people who aren't, going to be nerds about the ins and outs of all this history are still going to find them very beneficial, and they're fun to read, even if you don't know these historical figures or the context in which Van Til is writing. But if you do know those things, it's even better. And you find some of this stuff in Van Til's personal letters. A lot of it, you find the subject matter being discussed very strongly throughout the Presbyterian Guardian, but you don't find this tone so much as you do in Van Til's Dutch letters. It's really special.
And I also, just for the listeners know, I provided annotations to a lot of it. So here and there, he'll make a reference to something that happened in the Netherlands and old synods and church trials that took place. So I provided a number of annotations to provide some context to better understand some of these as well.
It's brilliant. What was going on? Let's talk a bit about the background. One of my favorite letters in this set is one titled "Afscheiding in 1936?" question mark. And Van Til is directly connecting something in his Dutch Reformed history, a split, a secession. You know, some people will say, well, these aren't really the same thing. You know, people want to be careful to qualify and differentiate the American Presbyterian conflict from the Afscheiding, but Van Til himself was making this comparison. And so he mm-hmm. believed it was a useful comparison, not saying they're identical in how they're working out, but there's something that needs to be understood here. And he's writing to his Dutch friends, his kinsmen, and people from the church tradition that he came from. And he's intentionally invoking this historical context in order to make a point about what's going on in the United States. Dan, would you be willing to explain some of this? You can, you know, go any direction you want. You can go forward or backward in time, but I'd love if we could set the table and explain what was going on in the Afscheiding and then why that informed Van Til and how that eventually came to be influential, at least perhaps in the background, for American Presbyterians.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's fewer, more important events than the Afscheiding, I think, for understanding Van Til and then his beloved teacher Voss and the Dutch Reformed influence upon the American Presbyterianism. So for those who don't know, Afscheiding is the Dutch word for secession. And in 1834, you had a number of churches within the state Dutch Reformed Church secede from it to form a new federation of churches. And part, you know, there's a ton of history behind that, which led to them seceding. But what you find going on at that time is that the king, so King William, had returned from exile because the French had come in 1795. And then in 1815, the Dutch regained their independence. And when King William comes back, you know, he's trying to unify the people for the most part, and was favorable toward the Dutch Reformed Church. But he ended up replacing the church order that the Dutch had been using, which goes all the way back to the Synod of Dort in 1618, 1619. And he replaced it with what they called the general regulations. And rather than the consistories of churches ordaining and so on, there was a council of statesmen and so on who began involving themselves. And you had the centralization of power. And along with that, you had a loosening of confessional requirements for ministers within the Dutch Reformed Church. You had this, the big argument over a strict or a loose subscription, the argument over the quia versus quatenus, insofar as the confessions agree with scripture, or because would be the quia, the strict subscription. Mm-hmm. And so they moved and loosened the subscription, allowing for non-reformed, at least confessionally reformed ministers to be preaching and teaching. And most of them weren't holding to reformed confessions at the time, mm-hmm. their teaching. And this loosening eventually led to a lot of resistance. There's even arguments that you can read during this time from a man with the last name Molnar, who had argued that even a Roman Catholic priest or a Jewish rabbi could preach in a reformed from a reformed pulpit. And so that led to resistance. Eventually in 1834, you had the Afscheiding. And this Afscheiding really formed the identity of the Reformed churches as a confessional identity. And I think that's the big thing you see really throughout the whole history of the Dutch Reformed Church. Cornelis Venema, who was the president at Mid-America, he just retired, and a good friend and my old professor, he had very well summarized that whole history, where he said that the history of the Dutch Reformed Churches is the story of a long and complicated struggle to remain faithful heirs of the confessional and church polity convictions of the 16th century Reformation. So the Afscheiding is taking place in order to, in many ways, return to Dort. I like to refer to those of the Afscheiding as the Sons of Dort, going back some 200 years to returning to their confessional identity. And many of the Afscheiding would then eventually immigrate to the New World and to America. They would settle in Iowa and Michigan. And that's part of the history, the tradition that Voss, his father, was part of. His father had attended the Afscheiding School in the Netherlands. And then when they came, they settled in Grand Rapids. They established a large church there and also a school where then Voss would come and study and then teach. And that was an Afscheiding school. And Van Til would likewise be part of that same tradition. And so I think it really just solidified in their minds a confessional identity as that which keeps the church afloat amidst modernity and all the changes. It seems that wherever the confessions were loosened, and wherever the confessions were ignored, it's there where the spirit of the age really crept in, and began to infiltrate. And so this idea of a confessional identity and standing against the spirit of modernity, I think it's for those reasons that Van Til will compare the secession in 1936
Right.
with Meiji and so on to the Ofsiding. You have very similar reasons for
Yes.
splitting, or seceding rather. And one interesting thing was the leader of the Ofsiding, Hendrik de Cock. He like Machen had been deposed,
His story is so crazy.
and it's so eerie the reason that's given for de Cock's deposal. And just to, I believe I'm quoting from actually Dr. Venema
Or De Young, possibly.
or De Young. Yes, it's De Young. Yeah. Hendrik de Cock was deposed, and the reason given was this, quote, "In order to maintain law and order in the Reformed Church, to protect the name and honor of the ministers of the gospel, and to prevent more disorders, divisions, and revolutions in several congregations in our fatherland." Now, what led them to do to read to state this, and what led to his deposal was that Hendrik was a minister in the Reformed churches, but he had never read the Canons of Dort, and he had never even read Calvin. And so a congregant gave him a copy of the Canons of Dort. He read it and
I know.
realized and was convicted of the Reformed faith. He began teaching it.
An ordained minister, and then a congregant gives him the standards, and he reads them, and then he's like, oh, this is interesting.
He's convicted of it, and then begins preaching as now an actual Reformed preacher. And people begin flocking to his church. And there's you can maybe go either way on this, but you had a number of people coming to have their children baptized because they found the churches they were in were not faithful churches. And so he acceded, and he baptized these people coming to his church, and their children. And that led to him being labeled one creating disorder. And so there's some difference between what Machen was doing and so on, but the idea that he was deposed in order to maintain law and order was the very thing that was, the sort of
Right.
the subterfuge for Machen being deposed
And then
as well.
also prevented from exercising his own rights and justice in appeals and courts. So there are all sorts of shenanigans going on also with his potential appeals and defense, and he was not afforded justice in the church courts. So that's
Yeah,
also
absolutely.
very similar to Machen.
Yep. And yeah, Van Til gives us a view into that in these letters. And Machen's considered a troublemaker for wanting to actually hold to their own confessions and its theology, and its church order, and so is Hendrik de Cock. And so you can see a number of similarities between the Ofsiding in the Netherlands in 1834, and then the quote unquote Ofsiding of the Presbyterian Church in 1936. And I think it's this history, right? Because you have 100 years, 102 years between those two events. And I think it's this history that really made the Dutch Reformed poised to help the Presbyterians in this struggle. This isn't to say the struggle ceased in the Dutch churches and they didn't have to continue fighting, but I think they had already entered the fray much earlier, and kind of knew the enemy a bit, and provided a ballast and some direction, I think, for the Presbyterians. So that even, you know, at their first synod or general assembly, the very first general assembly of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, there is a communication that comes from the Dutch Reformed in America, the Christian Reformed Church.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, again, Van Til makes mention of this, and as does Machen in a letter or article he wrote for the Presbyterian Guardian, I think just called the Christian Reformed Church. And there's a short article that I put up on Reform Forum website. You can kind of read some of this. But Machen mentions how this correspondence from the Synod of the Christian Reformed Church at the time in 1936 or whenever that assembly was.
Yeah, yeah, in June. They were the first to greet the OPC or at the PC of A at the time. That provides legitimacy because another legitimate Reformed Church is acknowledging that the Presbyterian Church of America, which was renamed the OPC, is a true church. That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
That they're not just these schismatic folks that are, in other words, you know, placing not a formal stamp of approval, but kind of like a formal acknowledgement that we believe you are a rightly and duly organized church.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I could read that there, the telegram that was sent, but let me give some of the background too, because it almost seemed like reading in Van Til and Machen that out of nowhere, the Christian Reformed Church sent a letter to them. And it was like, but you find out that R.B. Kuyper and Van Til sent a telegram to the Synod of the Christian Reformed Church, basically saying to them, actually, I think I have what was sent. Yeah, they sent this. So Van Til and R.B. Kuyper send the telegram to the Christian Reformed Church's Synod saying, and it's in like telegram, like shorthand. So Presbyterian Church of America organized yesterday as true spiritual succession of Presbyterian right. Church USA. General Assembly meeting now will conclude its sessions tomorrow. Machen is moderator. Our Synod could strengthen hands of brethren by sending greetings. So then you find out that Van Til and Kuyper were behind it, asking them to send it, which they ended up doing. And then the Christian Reformed Church sends a telegram saying this, the Synod of the Christian Reformed Church in session at Grand Rapids, Michigan, conscious of the tie that binds us in the propagation and defense of our common Reformed faith and convinced of the uncompromising devotion to that faith, which has led to your organization, extends its Christian greetings and commends you together with all who stand with you to the guidance and blessing of the King of the Church. May he lead you as leaders and those who follow with you by his spirit, strengthen you and increase your numbers and gird you on in the battle against our common foes of apostasy and unbelief in these critical times. Synod officially invites a fraternal delegate to attend its sessions next week, which I believe Van Til was the one who went in as a fraternal delegate.
There's also, I could talk for days about this kind of stuff. I'd love to, but there's more to come in terms of Stonehouse's relations and his view of ecumenicity, and he spent pretty much the rest of his life trying to work to unify the Christian Reformed Church and other Reformed bodies, not just in America, but around the world in some formal ecumenical arrangement. But that's perhaps for another day. There's one point in which the CRC rejected the fullest level, the highest level. I think this was in the 40s, and it was over. There was three issues where they didn't bring us in as a sister church, but they brought us in at one step down because they're a little bit nervous. The first was the confessional issue because we don't have a confessional membership, a strict confessional membership. And another was questions about our view of lodge membership, even though we've had a study committee report that was pretty much anti-lodge membership, at least specifically the Masonic Lodge, which is usually what people are talking about. But the third issue, if I'm not mistaken, involved a church in Rochester, where it was a CRC church split, and the OPC Presbytery received it without checking with the CRC classes, which, you know, from a distance, and I wasn't personally involved, but I would say, yes, we apologize. That is a really bad thing to do. So that was not right. And so they were wondering, you know, about our process of discipline. But Dan, let me ask you, as someone a minister in the URCNA, about Article 28 of the Belgic Confession with respect to this event, because this is a really big deal. If I can read a, an excerpt. It is the duty of all believers, according to the word of God, to separate themselves from all those who do not belong to the church and to join themselves to this congregation wheresoever God hath established it. And different continental traditions have had different views of this, and perhaps in its most extreme form, some people might subscribe to this as some form of apostolic succession, right? Where it's like there is one official strand of the or line of the family tree. There's only one of those lines that's the right one, and you have to unify with that line.
Yep.
Whereas other people are looking at it more theologically. But what's going on here? Because this is a big deal that this telegram was sent. It's not just, oh, let's see if we can partner with these folks. It's it's a theological statement.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think as you mentioned previously, right, it's a recognition that their secession wasn't a schism. It was a true returning to their Reformed confessional identity. And so I think this telegram is so significant. I think we see, you know, obviously when you get to the 1990s, the URC, the United Reformed Churches in North America, is founded as being a minister in this federation. We seceded from the CRC over a number of issues, though there are others. I should mention there are still faithful churches in the CRC. I was just speaking with the CRC minister a few weeks ago at a convention that I was speaking at, a youth convention, and many of them are continuing the fight. That, you know, they've taken a bit of a stronger stance lately on homosexuality in the church and so on, and requiring churches to repent or leave recently. And so there's a lot more to that, but there are still faithful churches. But the URC at the time, because of the centralizing of power and so on, number of churches were being forced to support causes that they didn't want to and didn't find reformed and so on. And then also you had this growing downgrade of the view of scripture and not holding its authority and so on, and sifting it through cultural lens and everything. So in the 1990s, you had the URC splitting. But kind of tie these things together, in many ways, the URC and the OPC, and even the joint hymnal that we have and the fellowship that we share together as two churches, is sort of the fruit of this. I think, right, you have this initial greeting from the CRC, which, you know, is part of the URC history. This initial greeting and it brings us to our present day in many ways, and shows the fellowship that we have. And so the URC, which you can go on our website, urcne.org, you can find papers that have been received by our synod in terms of like comparing the Westminster standards and the three forms of unity and showing their agreement. As I mentioned, we have our shared hymnal, the Trinity Psalter hymnal, and our own Christian fellowship. It really seems to be the fruit of this initial greeting and the sharing of pastors and theologians that's been throughout the years since the beginning for the Presbyterian Church, or at least the OPC.
Mm. So this is a CRC NA's greeting of us, and we've spoken about the Ascidian of 1834. Mm-hmm. But yet there was another secession, a grieving, the Doleance later with Abraham Kuyper. How does that play into the background of this as well? To my recollection, I mean, Van Til is conversant with and speaks about this at times. I'm not so sure I can't recall if he connected to the Doleance directly in the Offskiding article, but it certainly informs his thought there. What was going on in Netherlands at that time, and how does that eventually make its way to America?
Yeah, it's interesting. Whereas Van Til, I believe you're right, mostly connected to the Offskiding. Machen actually draws the line to the Doleante in that article I had mentioned on the Christian Reformed Church. And part of my thinking is because Abraham Kuyper became a bigger name, and Kuyper was one of, if not the main leader of the Doleante. And eventually, so the Doleante took place the sorrowing as they left the church. It really, because when the Offskiding took place in 1834, not everybody who was Orthodox and confessional left. You know, some remained to continue the fight, but it became unbearable and they couldn't remain in the church. And so with great sorrow, they leave in 1886. So you're looking at like about 52 years after the Offskiding. And this is led by Abraham Kuyper, who became probably the most well-known Dutch Reformed theologian in who's in the Netherlands, but the most well-known in America. And you have Voss himself translating and bringing Kuyper's works, Theological Encyclopedia and so on, as well as Herman Bavinck's works into America. And he's corresponding with B.B. Warfield and so on. So I do wonder if Machen mentions Kuyper as somebody who people would
Sure.
be more familiar with in the Dolianti and his movement.
When did he give his stone lectures? Was it 1898
Yeah,
at
yeah.
Princeton?
So,
Yeah. Of
yeah.
course, yeah, Kuyper.
Well, maybe double check, but I
No,
know
I
it
think
was
it is.
right at the turn of the century there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So, something that I found interesting recently was a period in American history called Holland Mania.
Yeah, I saw that. I love that. On the heels of the Republican National Convention, when this is several weeks later now, the DNC is going on here in Chicago. But we
Yep.
have Hulk Hogan ripping his shirt open, at the RNC. I'm waiting for the professional wrestling moment at the DNC. But I really want to see some Dutch guy just go all Holland Mania
Holland
on your
Mania,
brother. What
yes.
you gonna do when Holland Mania runs wild on you with its
Oh
clomping?
man. Well, in the Lord's providence, Holland Mania ended up being I haven't read anyone who directly connected these lines with in the theological and ecclesiastical worlds, but basically, 1876 was the centennial of America, right? So America, the Declaration of Independence, a revolution starting in 1776 and so on.
Foundation of the
100
Cubs.
what was that?
The Cubs were formed in 1876 as well. So I just thought
There
I'd throw
you
that in there. Really important to me. So
go.
going.
At least you're not the White Sox this year. I mean, it's gotta be. Anyway, I was gonna say one of the worst baseball records
No
of
common
all time.
grace there. Yeah.
I apologize to all my White Sox friends, fans. But anyway, so you have the 100-year anniversary of America, and there's a huge influx of immigrants coming in, and with that, they're kind of trying to ground American principles and values in a particular history. But they didn't want to ground it in British or English history. America at this time begins competing with Britain in terms of being an economic powerhouse and global leaders and so on. So they're looking for a different history that wasn't British to ground their American principles and values. And so they looked back to the Dutch Republic, the Netherlands. And you had the golden age of the Netherlands. I'm forgetting the exact years, but I know it ended around 1750 when everything kind of fell apart. I believe 1600 around there. Yeah, actually about 1600 to 1750, I believe, was the Dutch golden age. And so Americans began looking back to that between 1876 for about 50 years into the 1920s into 30s. And so you have this, in art and so on in America, you have like these pictures of the Dutch farmer and so on as grounding American values. But that same period in which Holland Mania or Dutch Mania is going on, you also have Voss coming into the picture and being brought to Princeton, and then Voss there bringing in Dutchmen to give the stone lectures like Kuyper and Bavinck, and there's some others as well. So I just wonder if like America was sort of primed to receive some Dutch influence, and again in the Lord's providence, I think it had some influence on the church as well, as it kind of gave a voice to this otherwise pretty small enclave of people in the United States. And in some sense, they've maintained that. I think that's part of the strength of the Dutch Reformed churches is sort of not pure isolationism, but we have pockets where there's a strong Dutch contingency populations, and many of their theologians are not the big names like that you hear, like the Machens and the Warfields and so on. But then all of a sudden you begin reading their works and you're like, these are brilliant men. P.Y. de Young is one of them, who I think is one of the most underrated Reformed theologians that has been in America, and his works, aren't really that well known. But I think that's part of the strength of the Dutch Reformed, where it's like there's much like hidden gems
Oh,
and the
yeah.
influence is there, but it's not the fanfare is kind of has a negative connotation. Not that I think there's good to having.
My theory is you guys are so good at this tradition is so good at putting the hand to the plow and just doing their work that they tend not to be great self-promoters or marketers. And so people don't end up knowing much about them because they're not talking about themselves a lot. So, which is good. But you also wish that there was more exposure and that people would unearth and celebrate these gems too. But I agree with you. Tell me about more about Voss, and especially as this connecting figure. So Danny Olinger, who wrote a biography of Gerhardus Voss that we published here at Reformed Forum, makes a really important case that Voss is not only a Reformed biblical theologian, but he's also an American Presbyterian. This was a kind of a great conflict because it was Kuyper, was it not, that what wanted him to stay and to teach in Netherlands. Voss's
Free
father
university.
wanted him to come and to raise the intellectual rigor and profile of the theological school in Grand Rapids, which he eventually did. But Voss, being a very significant and important American Presbyterian, wasn't perhaps greatly appreciated by his students at Princeton, but at least John DeWard and Van Til appreciated him, and he became, in many ways, kind of a theological father for some of those early OPC guys, and injected some important theological instincts and like a posture into these Orthodox Presbyterians. It's Charles Denison in his collected essays that the OPC Committee for the Historian publishes. History for a Pilgrim People likens these early Dutch guys as Dutch antibodies. You look at Van Til, Stonehouse, Kuyper, and then there's this extra figure of John Murray, the Scot, who serve as what other people would call an alien influence on the church. But I like to think of it like Mr. Denison, Reverend Denison did in terms of Dutch antibodies and Scot antibodies. So when certain people in the OPC wanted to turn the denomination into an American kind of cultural church, like culturally influential, politically powerful, a distinctly American evangelical experience, these dear brothers know nothing of this. They don't come from this tradition. While they love America, the land of opportunity, the land of many wonders, and are doing well for themselves in terms of, being able to farm and make a living and express their theological beliefs and ecclesiastical, inclinations freely. They nevertheless realize that the church and the state are different things with different purposes, and they're not persuaded that, for instance, the church needs to make a firm declaration about alcohol. It's never right to be drunk, but Jesus himself partook, and the Bible does not denounce alcohol simpliciter. And so these are kinds of things where they just weren't affected or persuaded by a lot of these cultural arguments. And because of that, not just on the prohibition issue, but on many issues, I believe the OPC was really saved. It would not exist today if it wasn't for this Dutch influence. It would have merged or it would have died.
No, that's very well said. And so just maybe giving some more context and background with Voss. So we had mentioned the offskyting had taken place 1834. Voss was born just 28 years later, 1862, in the Netherlands in a rural Dutch town of Heerenveen. And Voss himself recounts regarding his upbringing, saying, "Both my parents came from Graafschap Bentheim, where there was great empathy with the religious movement involved with the secession, which is the offskyting." And Voss's father, Jan Hendrik Voss, studied at the secession school in Kampen. He then pastored a number of churches in the Netherlands until he accepted a call to a church in the New World. And so in the summer of 1881, he and his family sailed the Atlantic for Spring Street Christian Reformed Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And going to Danny Olinger's book, he mentioned some statistics because, again, as we said earlier, that off-scouting, that secession group would really form the Christian Reformed Church and be that tradition in which Voss and Van Til grew up in. But Danny has mentions that by the 1880s, nearly 10% of Seceder membership had departed for America, so from the Netherlands to America. Part of the reason for the heavy emigration of Seceders was the societal makeup of the Christian Reformed congregations. They were primarily farmers and hired hands, not the Dutch aristocracy. When the Seceders individually and collectively made the move to America, they found Christian Reformed congregations to be similar to what they had left behind, both theologically and culturally. Right. So Voss is had just graduated from the gymnasium. I believe he was 18 or 19, and makes his way out to the New World, where then he would study at that theological school, which would eventually become Calvin. There he studied from the fall of 1881 to spring of 1883, and then he would go on from there to Princeton, where he studied at Princeton Theological Seminary. And following Princeton, he received a fellowship to go and pursue a PhD, which he did in back in the old world. And he went to the University of Berlin at first, and then transferred to the University of Strasbourg. But it was there that Kuyper had reached out to him, seeking him to be a professor in Old Testament at the Free University of Amsterdam. But as Camden mentioned just a moment ago, his father wanted him to come back and bolster the theological school in Grand Rapids. And so Voss honored his father's request and came back home in 1888. And that would be the last time he would be in the old world. He would just spend the rest of his life in America. He gets back. He's then installed as a professor of didactic and exegetical theology at the theological school. And then he delivers his address, The Prospects of American Theology. And it was originally delivered in Dutch and translated. I believe a translation could be found in the Kerux journal.
Sure.
But yeah, maybe kind of keep going
Is
through
that
the.
also possibly, I'm not certain, is it also in the shorter writings that Dr. Gaffin edited? I'm not sure if it is.
I don't think it's in there. I could be wrong,
Yeah.
but it might be. Maybe go somebody
I'll
can
take a
go
look. We'll
and
see.
take a look. So yeah, and then in this initial address, Voss begins to hint at the, not hint at, but he begins to sort of get his secessionist Dutch audience to be thinking about the Presbyterians as allies and friends in America. He mentions how, for example, just some quotes from the English translation. He says, "Our Presbyterian Reformed brethren have in the colonial era had to endure persecution and interference for the sake of their faith from the side of the Congregationalists and Episcopalians," kind of tying their histories together, right? We just had been persecuted. We've left now for the new world. Our Presbyterian brothers have a similar history here. And then he goes on to say in the same address that the Reformed Church, quote, "can claim for herself the inalienable right of being first in this country historically. She has performed the lion's share of the work in the founding and securing of this republic. It is, for all practical purposes, a proven fact that the Constitution of the United States is modeled after Presbyterian polity, with a hierarchy that moves from lower to right." Maybe from lower to higher, I think that's probably what it's meant to be. But anyway, I think Voss is already thinking in terms of seeing the Presbyterians, the Orthodox Presbyterians who are confessional, like Warfield and so on, as their allies. And if they're going to sort of make it and remain, they're going to need friends. And so if you fast forward a couple of years to 1891, so 1888 was his first address. He's then made the rector of the school, and he gives another address, which I think it's his most one of his most significant address. I know that the biblical theology address he gives at when he goes to Princeton is obviously extremely significant as
Oh,
well.
sure.
But I see Voss's address, The Doctrine of the Covenant and Reformed Theology,
Oh,
as
yeah.
really really just setting the trajectory of everything he's going to go on to do. And it really accounts for why he is able to maintain true religion, like in everything that he writes. Like just everything moves toward in this direction of just of true religion, of knowing God in his covenant relationship, loving and serving him. And so Voss delivers this address, the Doctrine of the Covenant Reformed Theology, and he begins that address by exploring a question: why, namely, why is it that both the Reformed on the continent and the Reformed in the British and English and Scottish traditions, both of them somewhat independently developed similar covenant theologies? And he says, it can't simply be that both had the principle of sola scriptura because they both, both returned to the scriptures. Because he says, well, the Lutherans kind of had a similar principle, but covenant theology isn't natural to Lutheran theology. They may mention it, but it's not sort of something that grows within the soil of Lutheranism, as it did in the Reformed and the Presbyterians. And so he goes on to say that it basically arises from a common commitment to what he calls the Reformed principle, namely that man exists for the sake of God, not God for the sake of man. And so it provided a deeper principle of thinking that unlocked scripture for them. It wasn't just the question of how is man saved, but how do we glorify God? And of course, within that second question is that initial question, so, how are we saved, and the glory of God in our salvation? But there's a broader, deeper kind of principle that they're working with that event that necessarily leads to the idea of the covenant, and then the covenant idea of providing structure for Presbyterian and Reformed theology. So I won't recount all of that, but you can, certainly want to read that article for yourself and explore it.
I love it. This is really important, good work. And it's fascinating to read about Voss, to learn and understand him, and then the people that came after him. I mean, we've been speaking quite a bit about the influence of the Dutch Reformed on American Presbyterianism, but is there any way that we might also speak of the influence of American Presbyterianism on the Dutch Reformed, whether in the New World or even back in the Old World? In what way might that also have happened?
Yeah, so there's a number of at least two significant, I think, ways in which that happens. The first would be going back to an earlier period in Dutch Reformed Church history, which would be the Nadere Reformatie, translated either as the Second Reformation or the Further Reformation. And during that period, you have some significant Dutch theologians, like Fuchs and Petrus van Maastricht, and others, Wilhelmus of Brockel. And during that time, you had really a lot of the Puritans being brought in, not physically, but their works being brought in and translated. And so you have a similar kind of a Puritan movement in the Netherlands, with their works being translated into Dutch and coming in. But then, if you fast forward to the period that we're more focusing on, you find actually a number of B.B. Warfield's works being translated, and being brought into the Netherlands. His work on Calvin, Herman Bovink writes a preface to that work as it's translated in the Netherlands. I believe it's The Religious Life of the Theological Student is translated in the Netherlands in 1913. And so you have a number of Warfield's works, among others, being translated and read. The magazine or the newspaper that we're talking about, that Van Til's letters were published in Diri Fumati, in that newsletter, you have a number of people mentioning Machen and Warfield. Even Maeselink, who had contention with Van Til, some of you know that history. He had wrote his dissertation entitled Machen as Apologist in the Netherlands in 1938. So you're kind of seeing
Or not, because he got appointed to that position, and then it caused the whole problem, right? Would eventually accelerated or led to the split or the reorganization of the board. Anyway.
It's interesting because Maslink is critical of Van Til, but he's also critical of Machen. And so you're like, and some people say, well, Machen was, in his apologetic approach, a classical, whatever, and then Van Til was presuppositional. But there's got to be something more to that, because Maslink had problems with both of them. So it's like they couldn't be necessarily just categorized in one or the other. It's like that would probably be
I need
another
to read
long.
that. I haven't read that dissertation, but I really need to read that now. I'll go find a copy of that somewhere. My
So
goodness.
yeah, you can see the movement both in both directions. And there was actually a pretty famous, I guess it was a boat, a ship that people would sail to America on the America Holland line. And it was very busy, especially during this time. People just and mostly coming to America, but then you
So
have
what are they
letters going
sending
back
back?
and
This
forth.
boat's got to get back to the old world. Or like, what's go? I want to know what's on that boat's manifest on the way back.
Right, maybe yeah. Other than just like letters like being sent, I don't know. But like, yeah, who's going back? Because I know,
Who
yeah,
knows? It's
I
a
think they really enjoyed their religious liberties, especially the offscouting, as we said earlier. And Machen even, I'm sorry, Voss mentions that as well in his address, The Prospects of American Theology, where he's like, we've gained all these new freedoms without any bloodshed. This is, praise God for this, and they've maintained that. Or we ought to continue to maintain that.
Yeah, praise God. There's been lots of conflict in the United States, but not the least of which, of course, is the Civil War. But my goodness, thankfully, there haven't been religious wars in the States. And that's been, our conflict is always religious in nature if we're thinking about it from the perspective of, the Christian worldview, the things we're battling with modernism and with secularism and all these other forces, of course, is of a religious nature. But thankfully, we haven't yet been put to death or imprisoned as Christians and as people have been in other countries throughout history. So I can, yeah, that's important, and that goes back to our founding and our documents and the Constitution, and most specifically and most fundamentally, God's common grace in providing for us as Americans. But what are some other things we might say? Do you have any other, I don't mean maybe to wrap, we don't need to stop, but I mean to wrap things up or provide a higher level perspective on some of these themes we've been discussing? Are there any items we haven't touched upon already?
Well, there's so much. I mean, the one thing I wanted to make sure was highlighted when we think about this history is that that quote I had mentioned earlier by Dr. Cornelis Venema, that when you think about the Dutch Reformed churches, it really was a struggle for faithfulness to its confessional identity, founded at Dort when it was solidified that we would hold to the three forms of unity, because they are in agreement with the Word of God and the church order there. So when you think about that history, I think that's the main thing, and I think one way, maybe a helpful way to maybe bring this to wrap this up is to look at very briefly, just to kind of list them out, the five things Machen commended about the Dutch Reformed Church, the Christian Reformed Church. I had mentioned earlier he had wrote that that article entitled "The Christian Reformed Church," and there were five things he said that had kept them from falling away into modernism, and positively has allowed them to preserve a truly Christian witness, to use Machen's own words. And so I think these provide a helpful summary of a lot of the things that we've been talking about. And so the first thing that he mentioned was separation for the sake of faithfulness, right? And he's saying that on the heels of their own secession, in 1936, and the Dutch Reformed offscheiding secession in 1834. And Machen said that it is a separation undertaken not in the interests of schism, but in the interests of the true unity and purity of the church. And so separation may become necessary at times, for the glory of God and for the sake of faithfulness, even if it costs influence, numbers, financial security, even just providing another small story, with the United Reformed Churches leaving the Christian Reformed Church, the ministers who left, most, if not all of them, because their pensions and their buildings and everything was tied to the Christian Reformed Church, for them to leave, they lost all of that. and left a large denomination and formed a smaller church that has now, grown somewhat. I mean, the URC is about 130 plus churches throughout America and the United States and Canada. But yeah, separation for the sake of faithfulness, and the willingness to separate despite the loss of things, is a marker of preserving a truly Christian witness. The second thing Machen said was theological consistency as the next mark. Machen says the Christian Reformed Church has never been content with being vaguely evangelical or conservative or fundamentalist, but has always endeavored to be truly reformed. It's not a mere Christianity approach to the faith. And that's been, again, a marker of the Orthodox Presbyterians, of the Dutch Reformed as well. The third thing, he had referred to the indoctrination by the pastors of the Christian Reformed Church. And by this, he means that one of the two services of in a Christian Reformed Church and in a URC church is going to be a catechism sermon
Sure.
that goes typically through the Heidelberg Catechism, which is divided up into 52 Lord's Days. And so it's a common practice to systematically take the congregation through sin and salvation in Christ, and then our service of gratitude to God in response every year. And so it provided a contrast to sort of an approach to theology that's disconnected. Like, here's an idea, and here's an idea, and here's a thought, and it sort of leads to this holding of the faith that doesn't recognize inconsistencies and doesn't really care about them because it just has some ideas, religious thoughts. And but this indoctrination became very significant. Catechism preaching, I think, remains a very significant thing within the Dutch Reformed churches. The fourth thing of the five is the exercise of church discipline. The aim of church discipline is the opposite of modernism's. Modernism always aims to join the church to the world. Church discipline, when necessary, right, aims to separate the church from the world. Where the world has infiltrated the church, it's there that church discipline becomes necessary to separate that and to remove the worldly influence out of the church. And so the exercise of church discipline, proper church discipline, is another marker. And the last one of the five is the maintenance of Christian schools. That was a big thing for Machen, a big thing for Van Til. I mean, so much could be said about that. But to have a distinctly Christian and a distinctly reformed education for our covenant youth has it, there's a strong testimony within, I think, the Dutch Reformed churches of that in terms of the ways in which many of the Dutch Reformed churches have grown through having children and the children confessing the faith of their fathers and so on and so forth. And I think Christian education, valuing that and pursuing that is significant. Our church order requires, that our elders are promoting Christian education.
Oh,
And
wow.
that became, something that's been in our tradition for a long, long time, and I think
Right.
shows its fruit as well.
And my wife works at our local Christian school. My kids attend there. Ryan Noah's kids attend there. We have a lot of involvement in this school through our church. And it's a wonderful and delightful school. But there are people at this evangelical school. It's freely association. It's not parochial school or anything, but it's also not distinctly reformed. And there are people from all sorts of different Christian backgrounds. And some people have this innate sense, like when we start speaking about family and covenant and this type of thing, if we're not overtly using Reformed lingo, that really resonates with people, but they don't have the theological foundation for it. And it's distinctly Reformed, and I'm using that even in the continental sense. Down in Mars, when you say Reformed or Presbyterian, we're talking about two different things, right? And usually in the world, Reformed is like small r, like anyone who has a whiff of Calvinism is Reformed, right? Well, not in America, not when we're talking to these confessional Dutch guys. Presbyterianism is a different thing, and I get it, but we're related. And it's been such a wonderful history, a hallmark of continental reform, the continental reform tradition, is education. And you bring this up not only in ecclesiastical education through the pulpit, distinctly with the catechetical preaching, but also with families. And that's an important point too. These aren't church run schools, but they frequently are free schools, voluntary associations that are governed by families. Typically also will have a church connection, and they might have certain bylaws that maintain that there's going to be some sort of doctrinal fidelity and confessional fidelity to the school itself. But I just love the whole connection. I mean, you really see this in everything Kuyper was doing in terms of having kind of a unified theory in a consistent Christian worldview through all things. You can like him or not on certain things, but I think you ought to admire him for trying to be consistent in every sphere of life. And that's something that's been so evident in the Dutch Reformed tradition, and something that really is, whether people know it or not, is the background of proper American Christian education. And we need to recover that. So we're kind of on a mission trying to do this. I mean, my wife's job as a admissions and marketing person for this evangelical Christian school would be a heck of a lot easier if everyone else had a book of church order like you do, in terms of the pastors needing to speak about and promote Christian education. But what we find most of the time is that pastors don't want to talk about it at all, because they might offend the family that has public school kids, or there's a public school teacher. And so speaking overtly about Christian principles with respect to education ends up becoming offensive, which itself, I think, is telling about our culture. Even the Christian culture here. It's wild.
Absolutely.
Well, Dan, it's been a tremendous pleasure to speak with you. I'd love to have you back. We'll talk more about these letters when we publish them. We'll talk more about the Joyful Fellowship when that book's out, which will probably be the next thing that's coming down and out through our pipeline of publication. But it's always a pleasure. Tell us a bit about what you have lined up. I know it's going to be a busy fall for you, and people perhaps would like to hear about it.
Yeah. So, the fall is going to coming up soon, beginning of September. So I'll be an adjunct professor at Mid-America Reformed Seminary, which we've been mentioning throughout the program today. And I'll be teaching ancient church history and apologetics, the first year apologetics course. So I'm excited for that. I'll be teaching in person twice a month. So I'm going to be flying out each time for the, September, October, and November. But I'm excited. You know, many of you know that I studied there. I did my MDiv there. And so to go back, I started that in 2013. So to go back 11 or so years later, really a privilege to be able to teach there. I'm excited and been reading tons of primary sources in the ancient, early church. And looking forward to diving into that. Also, I don't know if you know, but I was also recently nominated and elected for the board of Mid-America.
Congratulations.
I joined you on the board.
Hey, board member. Love it. Are you going to be at the next meeting? Is it that soon? Oh, great.
Yeah. So it all lines up. I'll be teaching a couple of days while I'm there. There's a board meeting, and then also the CME, the Center for Missions and Evangelism
conference.
So, if anyone's listening still and want to sign up, I would encourage you to come to that conference as well.
Absolutely. Lots of great stuff. Visit midamerica.edu for that. So we'll have to see what committees you get put on, but I'm on two of them. You can join me. Oh, that'll be fun. We'll see. they'll tell you where they think you should serve.
Yeah.
It's a great group. It's a great board. It's always a good time and fun and important work. So good times at the seminary. A lot of new renovations. They've expanded the facilities, new chapel, more office space, new board rooms. So you're going to get to experience that. So I'm looking forward to seeing it myself. I've only been seeing it through the pictures, and I'm looking forward to getting down there here. I'll be there next week doing chapel. So if anyone's interested in that, come on down to Mid-America. Visit reformedforum.org as well for information about all of our upcoming events, new publications, courses, podcasts, all sorts of things. It's available there. I want to remind everyone that we are a donor-supported organization, a nonprofit organization, and all of your donations can be tax-deductible to the fullest extent of the law in the United States. We really encourage you to support our work here. We love doing what we do, but we're trying to produce and distribute as many resources as we can free of charge around the world. We just passed the 6,000 student mark with our Reformed Academy, which are free online video courses on our website. We have many more students than that watching the courses for free on YouTube. And we love doing this, want to do even more of it. But we need your help, and you can help us out at reformedforum.org/donate. I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.